being can't be known, because that is a knowing statement about all of being. So there's nothing wrong. Now, if you took the laws of, let's take the law of non-contradiction and apply it to all reality, and this is one way to prove that it's not really a principle of all reality, because if you take L4 and bring it up here, and you apply it to all of reality, then what do you end in? A contradiction. Because you say, an uncaused being is caused. Because if you apply the law of non-contradiction to God, God is an uncaused being, then you're saying the uncaused being must be caused. So you've ended in a contradictory statement, which can't be true. So that's how we know that you can't put that up there, and it must apply only down here. Because if you do try to put it up there, it truly ends in a contradiction, and no contradictory statement can be true. But this statement, the law of logic applies to reality, is not a contradictory statement. It's self-evident, undeniable, and not contradictory, so it legitimately applies to that realm. Good question. Yes?
Are we saying then, let's say the mystery of the Trinity, the unity and the distinction of the essence is not contradictory to the law of logic, but perhaps the long theory of being that we can't yet explain in our finiteness?
Yes, and thanks for bringing it up, because that was really the other half of his question that we didn't answer. In the Trinity, you have a divine with three persons, and in Christ you have a human nature and a divine nature in one person. So the law of the reason that the incarnation of Christ or the hypostatic union is not a contradiction is because the law of non-contradiction says that it cannot be and not be at the same time in the same sense. And the phrase "in the same sense" means in the sense in which he's divine, in the sense in which he's human. So you're violating the law of non-contradiction by assuming that whatever attribute applies on the divine side also applies on the human side, because Christ isn't human in the same sense that he is divine.
That would be another
category mistake. It's a category mistake. It violates the very principle itself, because the law of non-contradiction allows for differences in different senses and or in different times. Since he's simultaneously, that time wouldn't apply, but sense would apply. In the sense in which Christ is human, he got hungry. In the sense in which he's divine, he didn't get hungry. In the sense in which he was human, he got tired. In the sense in which he is divine, he didn't get tired. But those are different senses, because those are different natures. If he didn't have that distinction between nature and person, then it would be a contradiction.
Our problem comes from in time and space, and out of time, space and time, and both at the same time.
No, the problem comes in, see, the law of non-contradiction says that opposites can't be true. One, at the same time, and two, in the same sense. And we're not talking about the time aspect there, we're talking about the sense aspect. We could talk about that. In fact, what does it mean, at the same time? It really means simultaneous. It doesn't mean in time as opposed to in eternity. And God is simultaneous to time, so it wouldn't have a problem there. But the problem really is there's a different sense in which Christ gets hungry, and the sense in which he doesn't get hungry, namely a whole different nature.
So the problem of the Trinity, we saw that by talking about the essence, and then on the other side, speaking of the person.
Same thing. And the problem of the Trinity is that God is a person in a different sense in which he is a nature. So he is three persons, and persons are different than nature. He is one nature and three persons. He is one what and three whos. And who is different than what. And if you don't know the difference between who and what, I can't help you. The spade is turned. Or another way to say the same thing is that God is three relationally, but he is one essentially. And there's a difference between relational and essential. In fact, that whole difference is essential to understanding what's wrong with process theology. What's wrong with process theology is they don't understand how God can be relationally many and essentially one. How he can be relationally in time, but essentially in eternity. And they reduce God's essence to his relationships. See, what God is and what he does are two different things. He is his attributes. He does are his activities. He is unchangeable. He does changing things. So we can have our cake and eat it too. We can explain how God is relational with the world and yet is essentially unchanged in himself. Where a process theologian has to deny the top line. There is no being, there's only becoming. We're on the question of the origin of first principles, and we're treating the problem that emerges from Aquinas' belief that, first of all knowledge begins in the senses, and there's no question that he holds that. He said, but the human intellect is in potentiality with regard to things intelligible, and is at first like a clean tablet on which nothing is written. And again, although the intellect is superior to the senses, nevertheless, in a manner it receives from the senses, and its first and principal object are found in sensible things. So everything that is in the mind started in the senses. But Aquinas also believes that there was one thing that didn't start in the senses, and that was the mind itself, which he calls agent intellect. In order to arise from sensation, which provides as such only a knowledge of singulars to a knowledge of universal principles, it's necessary to have the action of something that's superior to the senses, as the universal is superior to the individual. Such is the agent intellect. Although for Thomas, truth is not entirely from the senses, for the light of the agent intellect is needed through which we know the truth of changeable things unchangeably and discern things themselves from their likeness. The agent intellect in Aquinas is the mind with which you're created. It's that created mind that you individually have and that participates in the universal mind, Logos doctrine, but which brings light onto the senses. If you only had senses, it would be like a blind man looking at a room full of furniture. The furniture is there, it's giving off sensations, but he doesn't see it. The mind is the light, and this light enables you to see, perceive the essences of the images that the sensations are bringing you. Now, you can be sensing stuff but not seeing it if you don't have an agent intellect which can see, the power to see the essence in those images. The possible intellect is another aspect of his epistemology. You have a storehouse where you can put those ideas. Cannot have actual knowledge of principles except through the active intellect. For the knowledge of principles is received from sensible things, but intelligibles cannot be received from sensible things except through the abstraction of the agent intellect. In summary, the whole process of knowing first principles is this. For the first principles become known by the natural light of the active intellect. They are not acquired through reasoning, but only through this, that their terms become known, which comes about by this process. Memory is taken from sensible things, and experience is taken from memory, and knowledge of those terms is derived from experience. And when these terms are known, common propositions of this kind can be known, which are the principles of the arts and the sciences. Now, let me summarize that. How can you come to know that this is a self-evident truth? All husbands are married men. Well, first of all, your senses would have to bring you the image of a man that you learn is a husband. You learn he's a husband because your senses tell you he has a certain relationship to another woman who is called his wife. All that knowledge comes from your senses. You have to experience that first, or you could never see the truth of the principle, all husbands are married men. Now, once your senses provide all of that, you have to have some mind to see the truth in that, because all your senses do is bring you a bunch of experiences. What is it that sees connections? How do you see those connections? You see those connections because you have an a priori, innate capacity to do so. And when that active mind looks at this data that your senses bring to you and your active mind puts it together, all husbands are married men. How did you come to that self-evident conclusion? Through a combination of all the stuff came from your senses, the form came from your mind, and the proposition, the idea, resulted from that. So you weren't born with that idea. The idea resulted as a combination of the data coming to you through your senses and your mind, which God created, working on it and resulting in all husbands are married men. Think of it this way. Your mind is like a jello mold. Suppose you're born with star-shaped jello molds. They're all empty. The rationalists are wrong. They're not full. But when your experience brings you that... principles arise from judgments that your mind makes with respect to data that your senses bring. Now, some problems. Critique an epistemological problem. How can first principles be known from sensation if we are a pure tabula rasa? Answer, we're not a pure tabula rasa. In fact, this board behind me is not a blank slate. And I can illustrate that. Suppose you had a chalkboard and a piece of chalk and a white wall next to the chalkboard. If you take the piece of chalk, you can write on the chalkboard and you can see. You make an X. You can see the X. If you go over and write on the white wall, you can't see the X. What's the difference? They're both blank slates. The difference is they're different capacities. One has the capacity to reflect the chalk back to you, the X, and the other one doesn't. So even a blank slate is not a blank slate because it has certain capacities or forms to receive and relate. So your mind is born with certain capacities, propensities to reflect and relate, and it's not totally blank. So Aquinas says you're born with the capacity to know first principles. And when you see one, you'll see it because you have that God-given ability to see first principles. That's how they can be known from sensation. Next, what is this natural knowledge? Now, here's a whole set of passages that are almost totally unknown by critics of Thomas who don't study him. Thomas refers to the knowledge of first principles as natural knowledge, quote-unquote, not knowledge by acquisition. The problem is, if these general principles must be known first in order to know other things, and if ultimately they find their origin like all things in the senses, are we not arguing in a circle? And his answer to that is no, because what is innate is not the first principle. So he uses the word innate. Thomas used the word innate of first principles. He says the first principles of which we have innate cognition are certain likenesses of created truths. What's innate is our ability to know them, not the knowledge of them itself. Elsewhere, first principles are said to be acquired by a natural habit or a natural inclination or divinely instilled in us by God. Man is said to have natural knowledge of first principles or an understanding of first principles which follows human nature itself. He speaks of the mind being naturally endowed with principles not known by investigation, but which are bestowed on us by nature. Now, all of this natural, innate knowledge would seem to be quite contrary to the clear assertion that all our knowledge begins in the senses. How can it be both a posteriori, from the senses, and yet a priori, or innate? The answer is, distinguish between an a priori inclination or form and an a posteriori content, and you have the solution to the problem. We have a precondition. We're born with a precondition for knowing first principles, an unconscious inclination in that direction, and later we come to know them consciously by putting subjects and predicates together and seeing if they are right. This inclination is not voluntary. It's an involuntary natural inclination or appetite for knowing them, and therefore Aquinas is a Kantian realist. Kantian in that he believes in innate forms, realist in that he believes, contrary to Kant, that you know reality. You're not left in an agnostic position about it. It would seem that for Aquinas, a man has an innate natural capacity or form for the truth of first principles ingrained into his very nature by God. He has first principles in a kind of virtual and natural way as a precondition of all rational activity. That is to say, one can only know first principles if he is exercising first principles to know them. Otherwise, he would have no means by which they could be known.
Are independent of it, of being formed or acted a certain way by
sense? They are not that inclination that you're born with toward first principles is not impacted at all by the senses, except indirectly insofar as the senses bring you images and stuff that you put together by use of first principles. So if your mind brought you, let's say, John, if your senses brought you John, the man John, and his wife Mary, and you sensed that there was a man named John and you were wrong, if your mind put together John is Mary's husband, then obviously your use of first principle is indirectly impacted by the fact that your senses didn't bring you the right data. But on the other hand, the statement John is the husband of Mary is not a first principle. It's not a self-evident truth. Once you get a self-evident truth about that, John is a husband, John is a married man, your mind can't be wrong about that, even if it's wrong about whether John exists. Suppose John doesn't even exist. So your mind can be wrong about whether John exists, that your senses are bringing to you, but it can't be wrong about the fact that if John is a husband, John is a married man.
Another question about this vanity and
how does your personality impact first principles? Same way, not at all directly, except insofar as your personality will color the stuff that's brought to you, but when the stuff is brought to your mind, it will always work with regard to first principles.
What does that work when you color your personality?
Whether the stuff of your senses, I think it does work that. I think it works both ways. I think your personality colors how you sense things, and your senses color your personality. But all that deals only with stuff. Your mind cannot be wrong about a first principle when it sees the first principle. It cannot be wrong about the fact that it knows being. It can be wrong about whether this being now exists, but it can't be wrong about whether being exists. It can be wrong about whether you are a contingent being, but it can't be wrong about whether something is a contingent being. Yes, because that's the same thing that we were saying before, that it boils down to the statement, I know reality. And the statement, I know reality, is undeniably true. Statement, I know being, or the mind corresponds to being, or being is intelligible. All those are equivalent statements. Being is intelligible, the mind knows being, the mind corresponds to being. All of those statements are self-evident, because if you deny them, you imply them.
Kant denies it on two bases. One is the very epistemological gulf he builds by saying that you can only know the thing to me after it's formed. You can't know the thing in itself. And secondly, when you start to use first principles about reality, you end up in contradictions, paradoxes, antinomies. Now let's look at Kant's two things, because they're very important. See how Aquinas answers them in advance. One of the great redundancies of the history of thought is that most of the great deviations from a realistic epistemology were answered in advance by people. In this case, Aquinas died 1300, Kant lived in 1800, so that's 500 years before. The first part of Kant's argument, that I can't know the thing in itself, but I can only know it to me, is self-defeating, because he's saying, I can't know the noumena, I can only know the phenomena. I can't know the thing in itself, I only know the thing to me. Well, how do you know you can't know the thing in itself if you don't know the thing in itself? It's a self-defeating statement. So Kant's first argument in favor of agnosticism is self-destructive. It's I know that I can't know. And if you know that you can't know anything about reality, then you must know something about reality to say that you can't know anything about reality. It amounts to saying, I cannot know reality. Well, the statement, it is true that I cannot know reality, is offered as a true statement that corresponds to reality. And if it corresponds to reality, then of course it defeats itself, because it's telling you the mind cannot correspond to reality by a statement of mind which corresponds to reality. The second one, contradictions turn out to be false dilemmas. And I'll just give you one or two examples of it, and you can apply it the rest of the way. If you look at his antinomies, they amount to this. Everything must have a cause. Everything has a cause. Therefore, there must be a first cause. But if everything, second part of the antinomy, if everything has a cause, there can't be a first cause, because the first cause must have a cause too. Therefore, you end up in the contradiction by assuming that principle, everything has a cause, applies to reality outside of the empirical natural world. Assuming it applies to the thing in itself, the noumenal realm, you end up in a contradiction. Everything has a cause, so there must be a first cause to get it going. If everything has a cause, the first cause must have a cause. Therefore, it's not there's not any first cause, because it has a cause, and so forth. Well, it can't be both first cause and not first cause. Contradiction, that should teach you, don't do that. Don't apply these principles to reality. Just be agnostic about it. Well, of course, his premise is wrong. We don't hold it everything. We only hold it every finite thing has a cause. And that is not contradictory. Once you say every finite thing has a cause, once you get to an infinite thing, doesn't need a cause. Only finite things need a cause. So you don't have a paradox, you don't have an antinomy or a contradiction, and every one of his antinomies is answerable. The best place to read the answers to them are either Stuart Hackett's book, The Resurrection of Theism, or Garrigou Lagrange, in our notes earlier, one of the early Thomists, who has a book on Aquinas, The Nature and Existence of God. In fact, he has several volumes, but he has answers to all of these, and then we have them also in our Philosophy of Religion book, and in the Apologetics book, a brief form of them.
Going back, just to help me see the distinctional better, if you make a brief little chart illustrating the differences between the Thomistic epistemology and the rationalist epistemology.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the difference between, let's make a gulf here. Let's take Kant's gulf and make the chart and put reality over on the right side and our mind over on the left side, and the big gulf between them. And here's Aquinas on this side, and here's Kant, and we'll make them into the... They both have minds, and they both have forms. We'll make a little square-shaped form and triangle forms in their mind. Here's Kant over here. He's got the same forms. He's got squares and triangles, and let's give him a circle too. They've all got these little empty forms in their mind. And here's a here's Kant. Now you draw lines from Kant's forms over to reality, and an arrow, and you say, can't. That form can't correspond to reality. So none of these forms here correspond to reality. So you've got the can't. Whereas in Aquinas' case, it can and does. So there's not any significant difference over on this side, or there may be an argument about how many forms there are, how many basic first capacities for first principles there are. Is Kant's list correct or is Aquinas' list correct? But when we're talking about the law of non-contradiction, the law of identity, and the law of causality, they'll all agree. Kant has those, Aquinas has those, so those basic ones are the same. They might argue about teleology, but they won't argue about identity, non-contradiction, excluded middle, unity, causality. Kant had all those, and Aquinas had all of those. Difference is that Aquinas thinks they correspond to reality. There is a pre-formation, that the mind is pre-formed, created, naturally disposed toward reality, and Kant thinks it isn't. Kant thinks the proof of it is, once you try and apply them over there, you end up in contradiction. Of course, he created the contradiction by stating the wrong premise to begin with. Okay, let's draw them over here on the other side. Let's here we have a rationalist. Let's make Descartes or Leibniz, any one of them. Let's take Leibniz, draw him over here. He's got the same little things. He's got a square and a triangle, and he has a circle in his mind, and he thinks these things apply over here. So just like Aquinas, there are straight line arrows over there because he thinks his forms and categories apply to reality. The only difference is you got to fill in his forms, make them solid, because they've got content in them. You're born with the content in them. These other forms are empty, so you leave them open. Well, while we got the diagram, we may as well put everybody on here. Let's put Hume over here. Here's him. No forms there at all. The tabula rasa. There aren't any empty squares, triangles, or circles. There's a blank, blank slate. You can see he's in trouble. That's why he's a skeptic. Causality. Because the law itself has in it all finite beings are caused. I mean, the law isn't a law about all beings. It doesn't pretend to be. Once you make it a law about all beings, you end up in contradictions. Sure as shooting.
You would put like that there. You could say
Whitehead's
a big form, but
a form. That's a good question. How to diagram Whitehead. Every time somebody asked me to diagram Whitehead, I remember Whitehead's, I think it was Lawrence, one of the famous commentators on Whitehead, who said about Whitehead, and he was a Whiteheadian, that Whitehead never feared to sacrifice coherence for comprehensiveness. In other words, he never let the fact that his model seemed to be incoherent bother him in incorporating everything into it. And once you, I find it almost impossible to diagram these people. And I wouldn't know how to diagram Whitehead there. I'd have to think about it a good bit, and then if I probably come up with the same thing I came up with. You remember I had Jeff Amano do those worldview diagrams. You've seen my hands and worlds. I still don't like the one on process theology. There's got to be a better one than that. But I think, you know, at night I wake up thinking about stuff like that, and I haven't come up with a better model. It's just hard. It's hard to diagram something that is total process. See, his mind is in process. The forms, if you can, I can describe it. You diagram it for me. Here you have Whitehead over here, and he's got pliable, elastic process forms and process reality out there, and they're both in process.